It costs a lot to buy a house on much of the West Coast, and rentals are not a bargain in most places either. And the trend of low vacancy rates and therefore high rents and prices is not confined to the big cities. The price of a home in our part of the world is generally not as high as in Portland or San Francisco, but the price either to buy or rent is still not well attuned to incomes, even in rural areas. Recent analysis gets to specifics. Josh Lehner is an economist at the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis. He publishes reports on real estate prices and incomes from time to time. Josh Lehner, thanks for joining us again on The Exchange.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Pleasure to be here.
So let's start with a general picture. How tight is the housing market across Oregon?
It's extremely tight, right? We have very low vacancy rates, significantly lower than a lot of the rest of the country, and we continue to see in-migration as those young working-age households are moving to Oregon again, along with some retirees as well. So we have an increasing demand with a rising population, and our new construction activity it just hasn't kept up and hasn't kept up for quite some time, so that puts that pinch point on affordability, unfortunately. And the big point here is that it truly is a statewide and region-wide problem. It's not just confined to Portland and Seattle or maybe Bend and Hood River as well, right? You see it certainly in the Rogue Valley and in Northern California as well.
Yeah, so happening in all parts of the state for sure. When we talk about vacancy rates, I remember when I took economics in college, the idea of frictional unemployment, you generally weren't going to get below 3% unemployment. Is there a sort of a frictional vacancy rate that people expect you won't get above or below?
The rule of thumbs you hear out there, and these are coming from trade associations, I haven't seen academic work along these, right, is for housing, you want 5 or 6 months supply on the market, right? So the number of homes available for sale, if no more were added to the stock, you know, they would take 5 or 6 months to buy all of those homes. That's coming from the realtors' numbers. And on the apartment side, you know, something in 5%, 6% vacancy range is typically what people think of when they say a well-balanced market. And all indicators there is we're significantly below those numbers on both fronts, on ownership and renters.
You know, when we talked to people for a homeless series of interviews, a series on homelessness we did in January and February, we heard 2% in a lot of places. Is that what you're hearing too?
Yeah, I haven't heard quite that low. I mean, I see those numbers coming out of you know, southwestern Oregon. I've seen those reports as well. In Portland, I think the vacancy rate's more like 3 to 4%, which is still very low.
Now, there are some charts that come with your recent reporting, and in fact, we put one up on our website that's really interesting because it shows that household income on par between rural America and rural Oregon. But then, when you look at the single family home prices, how different is that in rural Oregon from the rest of the country?
That's right. I think you know, the fact that the typical household in rural Oregon, defined as every county that's not in an official metropolitan region, defined by the federal government, is on par with the rest of America. I think that, first of all, is a positive development in the sense that people always want to talk about Oregon's lower personal income and things like that. Well, it's not necessarily true in every part of the state. So the income numbers look decent. However, as you said, our housing costs are significantly higher. The single-family home value in rural Oregon is 30% higher than it is elsewhere in the rest of rural America, and then our monthly rents are 15 to 20% higher. So when you have typical income but significantly higher housing costs, that means households are devoting a significant larger chunk of their paychecks and their income to housing each and every month, which then has knock-on effects throughout the rest of the economy.
And if people are wondering about the income number for the average across rural America, it's $44,900 household income annually. Rural Oregon, $44,800, just $100 less. So essentially right there. So if the markets are being responsive to the ability of people to pay, and I assume that the rural rent is lower than urban rent, how do the prices end up taking such a bigger chunk of pay?
You know, that's the million-dollar question, and that's the thing that we're trying to decipher more. And when we're looking at specifically rural Oregon, and this applies to rural California, too, for that matter, the northern swath, I was looking at those numbers, too, same thing. We're seeing housing is more expensive for every type of unit, whether it's an apartment, or a single family home, and it's more expensive for every age of home, right? It's, you know, the vintage of the stock. So stuff that's built today, of course, is more expensive. New construction's always tapered or tailored towards the top end of the housing market. And then as it gets a little bit older, it becomes less desirable, and it filters on down to you know, middle income households and things like that. But you know, homes that were built in the 1960s in Oregon are still more expensive than homes built in the 1960s in the rest of America. And same with the 70s, 80s, 90s, and today. And so it really points to a genuine supply shortage of housing. It's not one particular segment of the market that's missing. It just seems to be that we have significantly underbuilt housing in Oregon, no matter where you go in Oregon, relative to population growth.
Josh Lane is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an economist at the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis. We're talking about housing in Oregon, particularly in rural areas where it's expensive as well relative to income as it is in the urban areas in Oregon. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Interesting thing you just said, though, about new homes tend to be built for the higher end of the market. Is that usual? The usual trend?
That is usual trend, right? Mm-hmm. Typically, they're tailored or built for the top third of the market, right? Again, land's expensive, materials are expensive, anything new is expensive, and so the top third of households are generally the target market for new construction.
So if we think in terms of the homes that are considered second or third tier homes now, or perhaps, you know, people think about using them as rentals instead, the people who own them, then this implies that we were always sort of underbuilding relative to our population growth. And that would have been a hard thing to predict, I would think.
You know, I don't know if it's a hard thing to predict. We have, you know, people have been packing up and moving to this part of the world since the dawn of time, right? Not just since Lewis and Clark, but since prior to that, right? People have been moving to the Pacific Northwest for forever now. We're expecting these trends to continue. So I think saying that we're not going to have future population growth because we have a strong regional economy and a desirable place to live, you know, saying that people aren't going to want to come move here is a hard thing to get to. And so saying that we need to build more housing because the current housing market is undersupplied given the low vacancy rates and rising prices, we know that. And we know future demand will be there moving forward. So we need to build some in anticipation of it or have policies in place in anticipation of that future growth. You know, I think if your baseline scenario is anything other than that, you might be living, I don't know, in a fantasy world.
But then you're asking people to essentially build some houses on spec, aren't you? Thinking that people will show up to get them. I mean, is the market? I mean, it seems like so many markets, and I'm not just talking about homes now, but so many other products. It's really a time to get the product on the market when somebody wants it, instead of far in advance of that.
Oh yeah, you don't build the housing 10 years in advance. There's no question, mm-hmm. right? And the issue here, and the biggest reason why we're having such a severe housing crunch in the last 5 years is the fact that the market has not been respondent to the demand signals for a variety of reasons. We're building more homes today than we did 5 years ago, but you know, in southwestern Oregon, we're building half the volume of new construction that we did, 15 years ago. Not since relative to the bubble, right? We don't want to necessarily get back to 2006 levels of production, just to get back to 2006, given everything that entailed. But in the Rogue Valley in particular, new construction is 50% lower than it was in, say, 2000, 2001, 2002, which is prior to the bubble, right? And so while the new construction has picked up, it hasn't picked up anywhere near as quickly as needed.
Any idea why? I mean, that's the million dollar question, isn't it? Why the home rate is low when it's clear there are people to occupy them?
Right, and so we've started to dig into this, and we've put out a report last year on it, and I think the biggest fundamental takeaway we took is this is a nationwide problem. It's a region-wide problem, and it's a nationwide problem in regions that have growing population. If you're in a old farm town in Kansas that's been shrinking for 100 years, like where my grandma lives, you know, they're not building any new homes because nobody's moving there. But in places that have a growing population, they've all underbuilt houses. And so this is true in Boise, this is true in Dallas and in Austin, and these are the places that lead the nation in new home construction. So when people say, look at Oregon and say we have a housing shortage, the number one thing they point to is our urban growth boundary and our unique land use system, or choose whichever adjective you prefer. Our office tends to say is that policy matters, and policy matters quite a bit. And I think there's no qualms about saying that our land use policies restrict the supply of available land to build on, and over the long term, it raises our housing costs. However, in the short term, in the last 5 to 6 years, you know, our urban growth boundary issues have not been the binding constraint on housing supply. Maybe they have been in Bend, but not most other places throughout the state. And so if we have a housing problem in Boise and a housing problem in Portland and a housing problem in Roseburg, you know, what is underpinning the entire financial system of the housing industry? And it's banks and it's lending. And if you look at loan volumes to single-family developers nationwide, those are still down 60 or 70% relative to a decade ago, right? The financial industry turned on the credit spigots for multifamily, and we got an apartment surge in all the big cities around the country. And that's starting to level off rents and help with affordability in the big urban areas. But they haven't turned on the credit spigots for single-family development. And in particular, single-family development for land acquisition and development loans. That means you're taking the raw dirt or the prairie or the parcel of land and grading it and putting in utilities and roads and things like that to get the developable lot. That's the chunk that was missing for so long in the aftermath of the housing bubble and collapse. That leads to the developable lot shortage today. Which builders are very well aware of, because we never did any of that land development in the first place for years and years and years. And that started to turn around a little bit, but we have a long way to go on that front. So I think the lack of lending for land development is probably makes the most sense as the primary culprit, because that's a nationwide condition and a nationwide problem. But of course, there's other additional layers on top of it.
So I want to understand, though, did it drop because of demand or because of supply? I mean, were people asking for fewer loans? Are they asking for fewer loans still? Or are they just not getting them?
Certainly both dropped, right? In the aftermath of the bubble and then a financial crisis, lending shriveled up for everyone, and the banks were underwater. And you know, there's talk about nationalizing the banks because the bailouts were so large and that sort of stuff. But it's clearly the demand has returned. Population growth is up. Home ownership in much of the country is rising again. We're just not building as much as we need for single-family homes in particular. And I think this is where the lack of land development in 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12 is coming back to bite us, because it takes a long time to take a raw parcel and turn it into a developable lot, and it's a very risky loan. There's no other collateral that's put us up against these loans. It's only the value of the dirt, and so banks are reluctant to give dirt loans and construction loans because they're very risky. And again, in the depths and the aftermath of a financial crisis, it's understandable that they wouldn't want to lend. Now, why haven't those loan volumes increased significantly in, say, the last 4 years? I think that's something to look into, and I don't have an answer for that.
Josh Lehner, again, our guest on The Exchange, an economist with the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis. I did want to pivot to one other sub-focus within the recent reporting, which is the idea that you have an additional issue that puts pressure on available housing in pretty parts of Oregon, the coast and the Columbia Gorge in particular.
That's right. And this is the demand for vacation homes or second homes, or, you know, homes that are owned by people that don't actually live there. They just come up and visit, or maybe they rent them out on Airbnb or whatever the case may be. And this is a very pronounced issue in a lot of our communities, in terms of, even if you're building new homes, sometimes those new homes you're building are specifically designed or tailored towards vacation homes, or it's starting to put increased pressure, not starting to, it has put increased pressure on moderate-priced homes, right, which you could call workforce housing on our coast and in Central Oregon and the Gorge and certainly down there in southwestern Oregon as well, where even if all the high-end homes are tailored towards vacation homes and second homes, that next tier down of out-of-state residents might be looking at, you know, a more moderately priced home, because they still want to be in the area. It's still gorgeous, the scenic the scenic views and the activities and the Shakespeare Festival and all that sort of stuff really attracts people to want to be in Southern Oregon. And so they're purchasing the homes that are in the $300,000-$500,000 range as well, which then has a knock-on effect where it pushes the local residents looking in that price range to look at other properties. And so we have a severe pinch when it comes to, you know, moderately priced homes, partly due to the increase of second home demand.
So Oregon is, to some extent, a victim of its own attractiveness?
Exactly, right? Yeah, the fact that people want to live here and move here is not a surprise. We just need to make sure that we're increasing housing to accommodate that demand, because the alternative is trying to put in some sort of massive restrictions on who can buy land and who can buy homes and things like that, which those don't tend to work well either.
Does the recent reporting or any of the reporting you do on housing markets come with any policy prescriptions, Josh? Are there things that you can see that could be done by officials at state or local levels that might affect some changes over a period of time that would be meaningful to people?
I think, you know, even within the system we have in place in Oregon, it's still manageable to have good outcomes, right? Ensuring that your urban growth boundary, because again, you know, the you know, Oregonians, they hate sprawl, but they also hate density, right? And and so you can't have it both ways. And so ensuring that there is enough land to build within your area and zoning it appropriately so you can have different types of housing products, is whatever the market and what the population is demanding. The urban growth boundary is supposed to have 20 years of land supply within it, right? So 20 years is a long time. So ensuring that that's actually accurate would go a long way. Making sure that we have some certainty in the permitting process. We're going through some stuff up in the Portland region where some developers are getting through the permitting process and the design review process where committees are not rubber stamping, but they're going through the process and saying this apartment construction looks good, it meets all the codes, it has aesthetics that please the community and stuff like that. And then it's getting to the final stage and the city council vetoes it at the last minute, right? So that sort of thing has a big impact on the development industry, because certainty is a big factor in whether you're going to invest a lot of money.
All right. Still a housing crunch in Oregon, even in the rural areas. It's interesting to look at the fact that household income pretty much on par with the rest of rural America, but single family homes about 30% higher in cost. Josh Lehner is an economist with the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis. Thanks so much for joining us again on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Appreciate it.
Take it easy.